everyone. My name is Stephen Downs. It's a pleasure to be with you today. I am speaking to you from my office here in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. And I want to thank you right off the bat for taking the time out of your busy day to listen to what I have to say. I certainly appreciate that. What I'm going to talk to you about today are the four major conditions for the evaluation or assessment of open online courses. And they are also the four major conditions, the four major design parameters for these courses. And the reason why these are important is because over the last few years, there have been a number of different initiatives that have created massive open online courses, and I'm sure you've heard of them. You've heard of Coursera MOOCs, perhaps, or EdX MOOCs. There have been all kinds of different MOOCs. And some of these have been based on the work that I and my colleagues have done. Some of these have been completely independent projects, and that's okay. I mean, we expect that. But they've diverged in certain ways and for various reasons from the design principles of the original massive open online courses. So my purpose today is to outline what those are, to look at them from the perspective of student experiences, and I'll be referring to a specific paper to document that, and then to draw out or explain a little bit more about what is meant by each of these and why it's important. So to begin, the four major design principles for massive open online courses are, first of all, autonomy. Second, diversity. Third, openness. And fourth, interactivity. You might ask, why did I choose those four things? You know, I could have chosen anything, but why those four things? They weren't just picked out of the air. They were selected because those are the principles that, taken together, ensure that a network functions most efficiently. Now, connectivism, which is the theory of learning, designed by George Siemens and myself over the years, is a theory that states that knowledge is the formation of connection, or knowledge is the set of connections, and learning is the formation of connections, either in the mind or in society. These connections together form a network. And what makes knowledge and learning possible is that these connections are always changing, always growing, strengthening, weakening, adapting to the experiences that we have. These four conditions, autonomy, diversity, openness, and interactivity, are design parameters for the most efficiently functioning network. Now, are they absolutely set in stone, carved in stone, permanent, forever true? No, it's a theory. I might be wrong about some of them. I might be wrong about all of them. I don't think I am, but it's possible. It's the sort of thing that needs to be validated through empirical experience. It needs to be validated by actually offering massive open online courses and seeing what happens. So that's what we've been doing over the last 5 years or so. We've been designing and offering massive open online courses according to these principles, and with some variation on some of these principles. And we've been looking at the results. So one of the courses we offered was CCK08. It was the first course that we offered. And in that course, we had three people: Jenny McNess, Sufei John Mack, and Roy Williams. And they've looked at these conditions, and they've also looked at a number of other massive open online courses, and they've written in response to them. And So what I want to do through this talk is to balance what I have to say about these four principles with what they have to say in response. And there's a PowerPoint slide that accompanies this video, and it's titled The Semantic Condition, and it will be available for you to review as you watch this video, and I'll be referring to it throughout. So to begin with, right off the bat, these three authors, and I'll just call them the three authors just to make it easier for ourselves. These three authors set two things almost as opposed to each other, the network and the course. And one of the things that they conclude in their paper is, and I'll quote, "Our findings suggest that these four conditions, might all be achievable in a complex learning network, but in a course, as opposed to a network, particularly a massive open online course, they can be compromised." This is a really important point. It's an important point because what it says basically is, it's all very fine to set up a network and set up the most efficient network possible, but if what you're trying to do is to offer a course, sometimes the things that make for good networks make for bad courses. And I think that's an argument, if it can be sustained, is a significant criticism of connectivism and a significant criticism of MOOCs. And it also has a direct relation on the work that people are doing, practically pragmatic people, in their schools and colleges and universities to offer MOOCs today, to offer open online courses today. So I think we need to talk about this and see what the balances are between courses and networks, or networks and courses. So let's go to the first one of these principles then. The first principle is autonomy. And this is, you sort of look for a quick one sentence definition of autonomy, and that's pretty hard to come to. Autonomy is not, you know, the absence of all restraint or anything like that. Autonomy is the capacity to decide and implement the decision of what to do in a given environment. You notice that autonomy just isn't complete, unrestrained, do whatever you want, whatever you feel like, because at all times, all behavior is bounded and limited, but also enabled and encouraged by environmental factors. Complete freedom to do everything would be like floating in space, and nothing would stop you from doing anything. But then you couldn't do anything because you need something to react against. So autonomy doesn't refer to the capacity to do whatever. It refers to that aspect of self-governance, such that when you are presented with a situation, an environment, whatever, you can make a choice and implement that choice. Now, I've written about autonomy, and there are, you know, and I've drawn from a number of different theories of autonomy in the literature. In the slides, there's a reference to my paper on autonomy. And there are different aspects of autonomy that I think are all equally important and are all elements of autonomy. The first is the set of factors that impact our understanding of the environment at all. What are our experiences? What is our capacity to understand our experiences or our cognitive states? What is our emotional or psychological response to those states? Autonomy depends on being able to perceive, to think about, and respond to an environment, even before any decisions are made. In order to be autonomous, you have to have the capacity to know, decide, and react. Crucially important. Then a second major element of autonomy is the actual capacity to act on a mental state. That is to say, if you make a decision, autonomy, you are autonomous if you have the capacity to act on that decision. If you decide to walk north, then autonomy means you can actually walk north. There's a variety of dimensions of this capacity. There's the physical capacity, nobody's put walls around you. There's the social capacity. There isn't some sort of social barrier preventing you from walking north. Structural, your legs actually work. And resources, you have the energy to walk north if you decide to walk north. All of these affect whether you are able to act on your mental state. Then, third, even if you can act on your mental state, there is the scope and range of autonomous behavior. Now, again, no behavior is completely free from all constraints. If it were, you couldn't do anything. The whole possibility of doing things entails the presence of walls, barriers, objects, other people, other ideas, things to react against, right? So what we're more interested then is not the absence of these other factors, but the impact of these other factors on you. So what is the scope and range of autonomous behavior? What are the scopes and ranges on expression, association, the selection of means, the method by which you undertake a process? All of these are factors which can create limitations or can help you overcome limitations. Finally, with respect to autonomy, is the effect of autonomous behavior. Being able to act, but not being able to ever see any results from your act, is the same as not being able to act at all. And so autonomy entails, to some degree, the possibility of there being a result. So this is what I think autonomy is, and I think that any assessment, any design of a learning resource needs to take these principles into consideration with the objective of maximizing autonomy. Doesn't mean full-scale, never changes, completely unrestrained autonomy. It just means maximizing the capacity of a person to make decisions and implement those decisions to improve their lives or meet their objectives. So the three authors that I cited looked at this, and one of their major methods of research was to survey students and survey them on what they thought autonomy was and whether they thought they had autonomy in the course. And autonomy was, and I'm quoting here, equated to flexibility and control over learning, and exemplified by the participants' choices of how and how much to engage with the course. And that would be consistent with how I've defined autonomy, but of course, perhaps not equal to what I've said. One student said, "Thanks to learner autonomy I thought would be provided in the course, I started following the course." This person would have been prevented because of work and schedule reasons, but because they had the choice of when to participate in the course, they were able to take the course. Another person talked about the autonomy of being able to choose whether to take the course for credit or not for credit. And again, that's autonomy with respect to objectives or goals. However, write the three authors, learners new to the environment and concepts lacked confidence and preferred structure, guidance, and even intervention to autonomy. They have one person saying, "Autonomy was less important when I needed full instructions." Another one saying, "I felt like some guidance would have helped. Freedom is great, but this course was all over the place. There was no one place to follow the latest thinking on any subject." This is an interesting comment because it points to a difference of view that people sometimes have with respect to autonomy. The fact that a person is autonomous does not entail that this person can never receive any guidance or instruction. In fact, quite the opposite. If you want and need guidance and instruction and are not able to achieve any or receive any, That is the opposite of autonomy. You are, in a way, being constrained by your lack of knowledge and by your lack of abilities. An autonomous environment is one that provides you with the scaffolds and structures if you need them, but takes them away if you don't. Again, autonomy isn't the lack of structure. Autonomy is the capacity to choose to use structure or not. It's up to you. Another student said that autonomy was equated with lack of assessment, and as a result, learner autonomy can be difficult for course instructors. Now, it's one thing to work without assessment. Sometimes assessment is useful. Again, autonomy isn't the lack of assessment. Autonomy is the choice of whether to be assessed or not assessed. You see the difference, right? If there's just simply no assessment possible, that is actually a reduction of autonomy. Full autonomy would be to make this service available if and when needed. But now we have the last comment about instructors finding it difficult. And here again, I'm going to quote from the paper. Learner control is not without frustration for the instructor. I recall feeling a bit frustrated that the concept of connectivism that I was trying to communicate, the neural, conceptual, and social external dimensions of network learning, was not resonating with participants. You know, there's a big aspect of our common concept of a course where the instructor has some knowledge and they're trying to communicate that knowledge to the participants in a course in such a way that the participants will receive it, understand it, and then actually agree with it. I don't think I was the instructor who made that quote. And if I did, I don't think I was right to make it. It's not about whether the concepts that the instructor has in mind resonates with the participants in the course. That's something that might happen or might not happen. But to many degrees, in many respects, it's outside of the control of the instructor. And in any case, even if that was part of what constitutes a successful course, it's not clear to me that removing autonomy is the way to address it. You know, and it's one of these instincts we have, right? We have this instinct, we're trying to teach something to somebody and they're not getting it. So our response is, okay, let's take away some of their autonomy. Let's force them to do something. That'll work. And the thing is, it often doesn't work. And even more to the point, it's not clear to me that there is evidence that it will work. You know, I mean, the issues that prevent people from understanding or accepting what is being taught are separate from how much control you have over them. The issues rather have to do with motivation. They have to do with clarity of presentation of ideas. They have to do with relevance or salience of the information presented, not whether you can control them. So I don't think that an instructor's frustrations with the students will be addressed by the removal of autonomy. There's a additional discussion of autonomy. The idea that not everybody in the course wanted the level of autonomy provided. And to me, I don't want to say that's not relevant, because it is relevant. But what I'm thinking is that if they wanted a different kind of course, one where the instructor told them what to do, then according to the principle of autonomy, what they should do is go to that course. If they wanted this course, the open online course that we're offering, to be one of those instructor-led courses, then they were in the wrong place. You know, not every course can be everything for every person. And the whole principle of choice here is that some courses work for some people. Other courses work for other people, and people should have the capacity to choose those courses and those environments which suit them the most. So that's autonomy. The next is diversity. And diversity is an interesting condition because it comes with a lot of preconceived notions, and it's often not clearly understood or drawn out. Typically, when people talk about diversity, they begin thinking of cultural or linguistic or even racial diversity. But to my mind, diversity is much broader than that. There are many, many ways in which we can have a diverse environment, a diverse collection. Right off the bat, let's think of the composition of a network as diverse. And what that means is that you can have many different kinds of entities. In the case of our courses, it means we can have many different kinds of people: old people, young people, rich people, poor people, people in Asia, people in Africa, people in North America, Spanish people, English people, tall people, short people, educated people, uneducated people. Many different types of entities. But that's just one aspect of diversity. Another really important aspect of diversity is that the many different people who are in our courses may have different goals or different intentions or different desires. It's a funny thing. There's been a lot of criticism over the years about MOOCs, not, people not finishing their MOOCs, people not completing their course, but very little discussion around what people wanted to do when they signed up for these courses. It's a problem if people wanted to finish the course and then didn't. That I would agree is a problem. But if they had no intention of finishing the course, if it didn't really matter to them whether they finished the course, whether, it was just, whatever, then why is it a problem if they didn't? What we need to be able to do is to imagine and understand that different people who are in a course are going to have different things that they want to get out of it. Some people just want a bit of knowledge. Other people just want to keep up with the field. Other people just want to be able to talk with people who are interesting to them. Other people are looking for resources they can put into presentations. Other people just want to be able to put down on their resume that they took a course. Other people are looking for credentials so that they can get a job. I could go on. The list is almost endless of why people take a course. Another way of thinking about diversity is to think of diversity of perspective. And this is one that, is subject sometimes to dispute and subject sometimes to not being paid attention to. Each person comes into a course or comes into any environment from a different perspective or a different point of view. In one sense, that's necessarily the case because, each of us sees the world through a different set of eyes. But we also have a different background and a different history. And we understand words differently. Indeed, we might even use different languages. Even if we both speak English or even if we both speak Spanish, the words we use might be slightly different. The jargon that we have from our where we work, all of these things reflect a different internal model of how the world works and what's in the world and what's important and what's not important, how you decide what's true and false, how do you decide what's right and wrong. All of these perspectives are different, and it's important to be able to accommodate and understand these different perspectives, to enable them to be equally valid within the course context. And then finally, there's simple mathematical types of diversity. A simple example, this is one I explored with Daniel Lanier, is inputs, how many inputs you have as a member of the course, whether you communicate with one person, whether you communicate with two people, four people, six people. And the more inputs you have, the more diverse the network that you connect with, just from a pure numerical point of view, the less likely there is to be one person or one member of the network that dominates all of the discussion. It's a pure mathematical relation. So, diversity is a subject of a lot of discussion, a lot of controversy. On the one hand, we have people like Robert Putnam or Richard Florida arguing in favor of diversity. On the other hand, there are criticisms. For example, there's a phenomenon called homophily, which is the tendency of people to hang out with people like themselves, and which is generally represented as a bad thing, but also generally represented as what happens normally online. And it's true that there's a principle of association that states that basically like attracts like, or to use the old neural network slogan, what fires together wires together. But this is just one aspect of the formation of connections, and there are many factors that influence the formation of connections and not simply similarity. So when we look at what's actually happened in our MOOCs, we find that diversity, we had a lot of diversity simply in terms of the numbers of people enrolled from all over the world. We found that we had different nationalities, cultures, ages, backgrounds, very much in evidence in the course. And again, the three authors observe through their survey that diversity was reflected in the learning preferences, needs, and choices expressed. And if there was anything that's a constant in our open online courses, it was the diversity of the participants. But now the three authors turn to criticism, and they point out, with some justice, I think, that there was little support for the hugely diverse group of participants, some of whom, they write, did not necessarily have all the skills or disposition needed to learn successfully or become autonomous learners. And they also write CCK08, and they should probably make the same point of any of the connectivist courses that we offered, was designed on the principles of an open network with minimum instructor intervention. But the complex diversity and minimal moderation were difficult to reconcile. They write, in a MOOC, diversity needs to be managed, which paradoxically adds another layer of constraints on autonomy. I don't agree that diversity needs to be managed. Or more accurately, I don't agree that traditional approaches to management are the best way to deal with diversity. And let me give you an example. In CCK08, we started off with discussion forums from the Moodle environment. I'm sure many of you are familiar with the threaded discussions that you might get in Moodle. This created a situation where people with different objectives and different backgrounds all entered into the same environment and began to clash. And there was quite a bit of discussion and concern about the role of trolls and the nasty discussion and all of that. So, partway through the CCK08 course, we discouraged use of the forums and encouraged people to use their own blogs. Now, there's one set of people said, "Oh, you're taking away my autonomy because you're saying I should use the blog." But you see what we've done, right? There was one choice, and we changed it to a situation where there were two choices, and you could pick one. So, to my perspective, that's increasing autonomy, not decreasing autonomy. But more to the point, think about the choices we as course facilitators had. We could either impose discipline on the forums and shut down the troll people and kick them off or whatever, or provide an alternative for people who didn't want to participate in that aspect of the course. We provided the alternative. So there's the way of management where you try to control people's behavior. And then there's a way of management where you create structures and environments that allow people to follow and pursue the course or objectives that they want. And I much prefer that second approach. I much prefer addressing questions of diversity and you know and the conflicts that occur as a result. I much prefer to address those structurally than legislatively. I much prefer to create options for people so that they don't have to interact in this way if they don't want to, rather than try to regulate the kind of interaction that people have. And the reason for this is precisely in order to support autonomy. The next condition is openness. And there's been a lot of discussion of openness over the years. And there's this sort of perception of what openness is. Openness is, you know, just share everything, everything you do. You know, you had lunch, you tweet it, and then take a picture and put it on Facebook. You went out cycling, and so you tell everybody that you went cycling. You have an issue with your instructor, so you make a video. But openness actually admits of many dimensions and many aspects. And when we're talking about open education, we get even more of a sense of different dimensions of openness. Let's take education and open education in particular. Think right off the bat of the different kinds of openness we can have. We can have open content, which is to say content that is freely accessible and freely reusable. We can have open teaching, that is to say teaching that takes place in an open space that anyone can attend, as opposed to teaching that takes place behind closed doors that only a few people can attend. We can have open assessment, and the difference here is assessment that takes place according to publicly knowable criteria and is based on public performance versus private assessment where only the assessor knows what the conditions will be. We can also think of stages of openness or the progression of openness that a college or a university might follow over the years. You know, first it adopts open content, then it adopts open teaching, then it adopts open assessment. There's James Taylor from the University of Southern Queensland came up with what he calls the logic model for the Open Educational Resources University, or OERU, which is a project of the Commonwealth of Learning. And these stages go from open content all the way through to assessment. But at the end of that assessment is credentialing by, you know, a recognized institution. There's another way of looking at openness that has nothing to do with this kind of openness. And this is the idea of open networks. If you think about it, you take a bunch of things in a network. There's two ways that we can organize these things. We can organize these things so that all the members of a group go in this pile, and all the members who are not in the group go in this pile. You have a very clear division between them. This is what I call groups. And then on the other hand, you can have everything all kind of interrelated, but there's sort of a cluster that forms over here, or a cluster that forms over there. And that's more like networks. And there's this different kind of structure. And when I talk about open, I'm generally talking about the open networks kind of thing, where there's a fluidity of movement in and out of groups, a fluidity of interaction and exchange from within a class to outside a class, within a course to outside a course. So I see a network as a clustering kind of thing rather than as an object or an entity. To me, openness as well has a lot to do with flow. It has a lot to do with the whole idea of receiving input, receiving experiences, giving output, creating output, the whole input, output, feedback loop. And these are all important because these are what support and enable plasticity. Plasticity is a technical term. What it refers to is the capacity of a network to change its own shape, to change its own nature. So what we need in order to support plasticity is an open network that accepts input, is able to behave, and accepts feedback, because these inputs are what create the conditions to enable a network to change its shape. If there's nothing that comes into a network, if there's no external input whatsoever, then there's really no motivation, no impetus, if you will, that prompts it to change the structure of its connections. We can only learn from experience. We can only grow as a result of experience. And so I think this represents an important aspect of openness. So now we looked at the three authors, and they observed that CCKOA was an open course. There were no entry requirements. It was free to any interested non-credit person, or you could also take it for credit if you wish. There were no limits on the numbers of participants, and that's what made it a massive open online course. But there was also, they said, the assumption in the course that participants would be willing or ready to give and receive information, knowledge, and opinions. In other words, and I'm quoting again, to share freely. And I think that's a bit overstated. There was the assumption that this was possible and allowed, I would say. But I would not say ever that there was the assumption that it was required. And, you know, there's openness in the sense that you must share and openness in the sense that you can share. And that's a really important distinction. I think if you start defining openness in the sense that you must share, then you're limiting a person's capacity to choose how they participate or interact with the course. Remember, the whole nature of the course is as a cluster, right? And by being a cluster, what that means is you can partake more or less of the course. A lot of people just wanted to watch, and that's going to be true of any human activity, almost any human activity. A lot of people just want to watch. You know, baseball games, soccer games, football games, hockey games, the theater, the plays, television, road races, just watching people on the street in the middle of the city. Most human activities involve spectators. And that's also true of an open online course. And, you know, you can't even have an open course unless you have some class of people who are the recipients of that openness and do nothing but watch. So there's no sense in my mind that everybody in the course has to share everything freely and fully. And indeed, some people wanted to form their own small groups off to the side, and we said, that's fine, go ahead and do that. What we did not do was say, but that's what the whole course is. You see the distinction. Traditionally, courses were small, closed, and you were either in them or you weren't. Our version of course is that It's open and you can be in it or not in it, sort of in it, partially in it, that's okay. Inside our course, you can have small groups of people who have their own small little group. That's also okay. And they can choose to share or not share outside their small little group as they wish. In a sense, it's kind of like a person choosing whether or not to share. You can have a small little group choosing whether or not to share. And these small little groups can float through an open online course just like a person can. Yeah, there's this tendency, and the three authors point to this, that openness within an open source community is, you have your free as in beer, free as in liberty and speech, and free as in transparent and therefore shared. And that you have to have all of these things all happening all at once. Well, our courses were based on and around open educational resources. And the courses themselves were structured openly. But it does not follow that because the course is open, that every single aspect of the course must be open. That would be to commit what they call the fallacy of division. So I wasn't concerned at all that people were getting, quote, a free ride. No more than I'm concerned that an audience in a movie theater is getting a free ride. There were many different levels of behavior, many different levels of expertise. And I've always said people need first to be able to watch and observe as other people model and demonstrate whatever it is they're trying to learn. And only later on, once you kind of got the idea, do you actually get into it and start practicing it for yourself. And I think that's true in the case of these open online courses. The aspect of open that to me is the most important in our open online courses is the use of open educational resources. Not because they are teaching materials, but because we use these resources as the language or the vocabulary with which to talk to each other in the course. We typically think of the course as, it's just somebody speaks in a language, somebody else speaks in a language, we speak back and forth in English or whatever. But if you actually look at most courses, you look at any course pretty much, that's not what happens. Yes. You use English or Spanish, whatever language you use, but you also use objects, diagrams, experiments, performances, etc. There's a whole range of different things. And all of these things taken together constitute the communication that takes place between instructor and participants or participants with each other. And openness in this sense means that the language of communication is something that can be shared with and used by anybody in the course. And so I think that a connectivist course, especially a network-based course, especially needs to use open educational resources. Finally, fourth is interactivity. Now, interactivity isn't just the fact that people can communicate back and forth with each other in a course. Now, it requires that. But I mean something more than that. Typically, in a traditional course, the way the course is structured, the instructor knows something, has some fact or concept or idea. And the way the course will proceed is that concept or idea will go from the instructor's brain through some process of communication into the brains of all the other people in the course. So if you have a big A in the instructor, at the end of the course, you have big A's in each of the individual students. Well, that's what you might call a distributive model of course organization. The instructor distributes an idea to everybody else in the course. It's what they talk about sometimes when they talk about the propagation of memes or ideas or things like that. But interactivity, in the sense that I mean it, is as follows, where each person in the course, including the instructor, has some content and they share that content with other people. So the instructor shares A with all the people in the course. One of the students shares V with all the people in the course. Someone else shares S with all the people in the course. So you get A's and V's and S's and all of that. And there's no single message that goes from the instructor to all the students. There's a whole bunch of different messages. And so you have this whole sort of interactive layer of different messages going back and forth and back and forth. And then out of that emerges something new, AVSF, which is a creation of all of those interactions together. It did not actually exist in anyone's head before the course started. It was something that was created as a result of the process of the course. This kind of knowledge is called emergent knowledge. And it's the kind of knowledge that happens when you recognize or perceive patterns in complex phenomena, like, for example, interactive networks. Emergent knowledge is like when you look at a television and all you see are the little pixels, but you recognize a picture of a person that you know, Richard Nixon or someone on the TV. Emergent knowledge is one thing that comes out of a whole bunch of different things. You know, the TV doesn't have a whole bunch of little pictures of Richard Nixon, it just has pixels. And so you have the relationship and the organization of the pixels, and out of that organization comes the concept. So that's the concept here. Interactivity, a massive open online course, aims for knowledge based on interactivity. That is to say, it creates an environment in which interaction and communication happens, from which what is learned by the participants, including the instructor, will emerge as a consequence. It's a very different sort of perception. It's a different way of thinking about how we learn, and not just that, what we learn from a course. So I don't think that this concept really was grasped by the participants, nor by the three authors who were criticizing McNess, Mack, and Williams. They said they looked at the wide range of connections. They quoted one participant about connecting through email and connecting through texting and audio streams and responding on blogs and all of that. And then said, you know, these nodes of connection were meaningful places, even if temporary connections only. Which sort of, you know, it gets at the connection part, but it doesn't get at the emergent knowledge part. And they seem to think that, you know, the objective of this was to create a whole bunch of interactions. At one point they say, and again I'm quoting, whilst connectedness was afforded by the technology, it did not necessarily ensure interaction. As Siemens 2009 says, the question for me is not how are people connected, but what are the implications of people being connected in a certain way? And I think Siemens is onto that. He says frequency of contact isn't that important. It's not, you know, the more interaction, the better, the less interaction, the worse. That's not the objective at all. I remember seeing a presentation by Francisco Varela at the University of Alberta Hospital many years ago. He's talking about the immune system, and there's a sweet spot of connectivity, a sweet spot where, you know, it's not zero connectivity, it's not 100% connectivity, it's somewhere in the middle. You want your network, you want the entities in your network to be connected, but being connected isn't what they're all about. You know, you want them to be partially connected, not fully connected. If every entity in a network was connected to every other entity and interacting with every other entity, you have ridiculous noise, right? What you want in your network is the capacity for your entities in the network, your participants in a course, to be able to pick and choose their connections. So, not more interactivity, but better interactivity that, man, I don't want to say made sense, but interactivity that they could deal with, that did not overwhelm them. It's not so much about, enabling more communications or barriers to communications, although those are factors. It's getting the right kind of communications at the right time. So while the paper by the three authors focused a lot on the barriers, on the trolls that were in the discussion list, on the quality of personal connections, on the barriers created by levels of expertise, I think when you just focus on the barriers to communications like that, you kind of miss the point. The experts aren't always going to communicate with the novices. It's probably not appropriate that they do. The experts communicate with the slightly less than experts, who communicate with a little bit less than experts. And eventually you get, the junior people are communicating with the novices. And you get connections and interactions that are appropriate to your time and to your place. So if a person is, simply not able to understand the interactions, or sorry, not able to understand the issues anymore, that tells me not that they're not getting enough interactivity, but that they should be looking for the right kind of interactivity, that the wrong, they're talking to the wrong people. And there should be mechanisms in place to allow them to find and talk to the right people. So, the three authors say the more open the course, the more this becomes a dilemma for the course designers. I disagree. The more open the course, the more opportunities there are for a person to find and connect with the appropriate people. It's not a case of everybody talks to everybody. It's a case of picking the right people and talking at the right level. I talk an awful lot about the process of learning becoming a process of restating what is told to you in your own language, but you can only do that if you can comprehend what's being told to you in the first place. So, those four things overall: autonomy, diversity, openness, and interactivity are, as I said, the major design parameters for a massive open online course, a network-based course. And it's important to understand that although they've posed challenges from the traditional perspective of a course, there is not a contradiction between offering a network and offering a course. A course can be a network. But we need to understand that when we're building a network-based course, that the parameters of autonomy, diversity, openness, and interactivity are not simple one-dimensional parameters that if they're not working perfectly, you just use some management from your traditional course management skills to do. Rather, it's important from the perspective of a course designer to understand that all of these things, autonomy, diversity, openness, and interactivity, work across multiple dimensions. That there are aspects of autonomy, aspects of diversity, aspects of openness and interactivity that interact with each other. And so none of them are as simple, everything goes, or everything's open, or some sort of vague statement like that. And that when you run into a problem with one of them, it's probably because you focused more on one aspect and less on another one of the aspects. And so I think that, when autonomy, for example, poses a challenge in course management, the way to respond is not by clamping down on autonomy. Generally, the way to respond is to understand where that person's autonomy is being blocked and to attempt to provide this new type of autonomy. So, what I'd like you to take out of this, because I don't expect anyone to memorize all of the stuff that I've just said here today, what I'm trying to do here is to give people a sense that what's happening in a massive open online course is not just the implementation of new technology to a traditional online class or online course, but it's a different way of looking at how we organize these online classes and online courses. And that these principles, autonomy, diversity, interactivity, and openness, are principles that govern, hardly govern the technology at all. They govern our attitude and they govern our style and our mechanisms for interacting with other people, not just in open online courses, although that's important, but interacting with people in general.